Avalara provides cloud-based sales tax solutions for businesses of all sizes. Avalara automatically integrates with more than 700 ERP and e-commerce systems, likely the systems you use today. Learn more at avalara.com/WSJ.
This is your tech news briefing for Monday, December 28th. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. In the final few days of 2020, we're taking a look back at how tech fared this year, the highs and lows and big moves. It goes without saying that this was a very weird year. Many of us became completely dependent on technology to go to work or school, entertain ourselves, and even get groceries. But while tech companies benefited in many ways, an economic downturn had many consumers watching their budgets. On today's episode, we take a look at how companies from Zoom to Peloton use the lever of pricing to manage the pandemic's obstacles and capitalize on its opportunities. Our personal tech columnist, Nicole Nguyen, will join me to talk all about it after the break.
Avalara is known as a pioneer in sales tax automation. Since 2004, Avalara has been providing cloud-based sales tax solutions for businesses of all sizes. Avalara automatically integrates with more than 700 ERP and e-commerce systems, likely the systems you use today. Find out how your business can save time and reduce risk at avalara.com/WSJ. That's AVALARA.com/WSJ. Avalara, tax compliance done right.
Chances are you've changed the way you spend your money this year, and the tech companies have noticed. Everyone from Apple to Amazon to Zoom has been experimenting with the way they price their products to try and entice and keep customers. Joining me now to talk about some of their strategies is our personal tech columnist, Nicole Nguyen. Hey, Nicole, thanks for being here.
Hi, Amanda.
Okay, so we're going to run through the specifics in a minute, but I first want to start by asking, why look at tech companies' pricing moves this year? What do these decisions tell us about the companies?
It's a great question. I was curious about whether or not the economic downturn prompted by this very unique pandemic would prompt companies to consider new pricing models or in what ways it would test traditional pricing schemes. And the reason why it's unique is because economic downturns sometimes forces prices down. And so in this case, no one was flying. And so some flight prices went down. Some airlines offered buy one, get two free seats deals. But in other cases, prices went up because grocery demand was higher, because supply chains were in disarray, because operational costs were higher for places like restaurants. So it's this really interesting look at how companies are reacting to this unique time. I think we often think about economics and pricing models as firm, that nothing is new and that there are no real experiments in pricing. But the truth is, when there is a moment like this one, nobody really knows how consumers are going to react. And so in a way, a lot of these companies are conducting experiments.
And we saw a lot of companies take some different approaches to that. So let's run through some of the examples we saw. And we'll start with entertainment. Remind us, how did Hollywood adjust in the world of closed movie theaters?
Obviously, it was a huge hit to the movie theater industry because being locked in a closed room for 2 hours isn't exactly COVID-friendly. Disney took an interesting approach. It launched Disney Plus very recently, and that was probably a saving grace for the company because there were lots of areas of the company that were not doing well, like theme parks, for example. And Mulan was one of its biggest blockbusters this year. It's a $200 million movie. It's the remake of a classic, a favorite of mine. And they decided, instead of releasing it exclusively in theaters, which is normal, to charge $30 for early access to Mulan, what they call premiere access. And it was an interesting move because they were going to charge $30, which is a pretty high price for a streaming service as an add-on to what you're already paying, which is $6.99 a month for Disney Plus, and offer that early access for 3 months, and then make Mulan a part of the larger library in December for Centrally Free included in your subscription.
So kind of just charging the price that it would cost to go see the movie at the theater, but from your couch. Now, Mulan might be a bit of an anomaly because of a number of factors, including concerns over where the movie was filmed, which was in a part of China where the government has been accused of committing some human rights abuses. But that in mind, how was Mulan received? Did the gamble pay off?
It fell flat, most analysts say, because of two reasons. One is because there was a lot of controversy around the filming location. The CEO admitted this himself. And the second reason is that the price is really high. And instead of framing the premier access price as a discount for Disney Plus subscribers, so, you know, they could have charged $40 for non-subscribers and $30 or $25 for subscribers to make it feel like you're getting something out of it, you know, a deal. They charge this premium price to subscribers.
So Mulan didn't quite work out, it sounds like, but is this something that streaming services and entertainment more broadly might keep testing?
Interestingly, one of Disney's biggest rivals, Warner Media, decided to release its entire 2021 slate of films included with HBO Max, not opting for the premier pricing model, and Disney's next release, which is Pixar's Soul, will be included in the Disney Plus subscription and not as a premier add-on. So, you know, that sort of indicates that Mulan didn't do super well for Disney, but I do suspect that if we are staying away from movie theaters well into 2021, well into 2022, that they will try this again for another blockbuster release, maybe with a lower price.
Got it. Okay, so let's move on to Apple. They released a ton of new products this year and played on what you have dubbed the Goldilocks effect. Can you tell us what that means?
Goldilocks refers to a good, better, best pricing strategy. So this means you get three options or three buckets of options that represent sort of like the budget, the mid-tier, and then the expensive model for those who have a very high willingness to pay for the latest and greatest features. Apple, for a long time, has released new models, one or two, and then discounted previous models, older models, to sort of represent that good, better, best strategy. So the budget option was always like last year's iPhone. This year, they released a record number of new iPhone models, so five in total. And actually, the budget option is a new phone that was released this year. So I think what that says about Apple is that moving forward, they want their entire lineup, their new lineup, to represent more pricing tiers to appeal to a wider swath of people. So even those who are willing to spend just a couple $100 on a phone can feel like they're getting a new iPhone.
So sort of expanding their addressable market. And as you mentioned, this is a tactic that Apple has used since long before the pandemic. But is there a reason they're sort of doubling down on this in a year like this one?
Yeah, you know, one of the pricing consultants I talked to says that more pricing tiers is kind of a protective measure for some companies. Apple is a premium brand, so they can get away with selling a multi-$1,000 iPhone during an economic downturn. But the lower end, you know, that iPhone SE, that's just a couple $100, you know, between $300 and $400, allows them to keep the customer that has a tighter budget in their brand, and hopefully that person will upgrade to a more expensive phone in the future.
Got it. And in a similar pricing move, the fitness company Peloton introduced another more expensive stationary bike and lowered the price of the existing model by about $350. So what's the logic with this move?
Yeah, so it's not exactly good, better, best because it's a two-tiered pricing system. A lot of economists call this pretty classic price discrimination, where someone who has a high willingness to pay for more features will pay for the very expensive $2,495 bike plus with all the bells and whistles. And those who are maybe just starting to get into stationary biking but really want a Peloton are willing to pay the $1,895 price. This one research paper that I discussed in the piece looked at this Williams-Sonoma case where a $275 bread baking appliance wasn't selling at all. And then Williams-Sonoma offered a more expensive model, and then the cheaper model sales doubled. So, you know, Peloton may have been drawing from this classic case here. We don't have exact numbers on its performance, but in earnings calls, Peloton was very bullish on its cheaper model and said that it would continue to be its best-selling bike, but what happened is during the pandemic, people were more willing to pay for premium equipment because it was replacing their gym membership. And so wait times for this newer Bike Plus are now up to 10 weeks, and wait times for the cheaper bike are, you know, almost half that time. So it seems like maybe Peloton should have priced their more expensive bike maybe even higher, or maybe their less expensive bike even more affordable.
So I think that brings us to the fourth big pricing strategy we saw, which is this trend of companies dropping paywalls and generally making more of their product or service accessible for free. Can you just remind us some of what we saw there?
Yeah, so early on in the pandemic, a lot of companies were responding to this very sudden turn towards work from home and being online and not really being able to communicate with other people in person. So Zoom, for example, lifted their 40-minute limit for K-12 educators. AT&T and other service providers lifted data caps. Comcast made its network of Xfinity Wi-Fi access points free for everyone, so you don't need a Comcast subscription. The list goes on and on. What they're sort of taking advantage of is the fact that free is great advertising. And free does something really miraculous to our brains. You know, we're very persuaded by $0. There was this very famous study of students who had the choice between a 1 cent Hershey's Kiss or a 26 cent Lindt truffle. And when given that choice, most students picked the Lindt truffle. But when the researchers lowered the price of the Hershey's Kiss to free and the Lindt truffle to, you know, just 1 cent below, even though the price difference was the same, most students opted for the free Hershey's Kiss. So free has a very strong pull on our psyche, and these companies think that in offering free services, they spread goodwill, but they also increase the amount of people who are using their service. And the thinking is that potentially those people will pay for other things in the long term. So Nike is a good example of this. They made their training club app free. The premium subscription cost some amount of money to be able to work out with their very chiseled, very good-looking trainers. And these trainers are wearing Nike clothing, and there's a shortcut in the app to buy Nike apparel. And so in making the app free, they were able to sell more Nike goods. So they're actually making it free permanently.
Yes, that Nike move definitely worked on me.
Nice.
But I wonder, aside from that, what is the business case for this option? I think I'm still a free user of Zoom, for instance, which is not making them any money, as far as I know.
We have seen some indications that this is really working for some companies. Zoom was extremely well positioned to do well this year. But in making their service free, they got more people acquainted with the service, and they started rolling out new products like this new pricing page for people like trainers to charge for Zoom sessions. And so I think if you're used to using a service, you're more willing to hand over your credit card to that service, and their revenue shot up, you know, something like over 300% this year, year over year. That may have something to do with the fact that Zoom was like the premier video conferencing tool that we all leaned on, but it also has to do with the fact that they have a really robust free tier that allows most people to use the service without paying for extra stuff.
Finally, we have the subscription model, and it sounds like the grocery delivery market is a good example of this.
Yeah, so home delivery exploded this year. It allowed people to stay away from grocery stores, which all of a sudden became a dangerous activity. And Walmart really capitalized on this moment by offering a subscription service. It's called Walmart Plus, and it includes free and limited delivery from local stores. The thinking is that it pays for itself in just two deliveries, Walmart says. What's interesting about this example is that, you know, Walmart really rushed this program out, and so they had very scant perks. And the program cost $13 a month. So the easiest comparison, the laziest comparison is to Amazon Prime, which on top of free unlimited delivery offers, you know, this giant entertainment bundle, free photo storage, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it was hard for people to justify the price between Walmart Plus and Amazon Prime. But we don't have numbers for Walmart Plus yet, and it may very well have been a success. And Walmart Plus and Amazon Prime aim to do the same thing, which is try to make Walmart or Amazon the default shopping choice in our mind. And I think Walmart Plus is a good way for Walmart to become more salient in people's minds.
Yeah, and let's just break that down a little bit more. How does the subscription model actually work to create sort of a stickier relationship with consumers?
Yeah, other examples are DashPass, which is DoorDash's new membership tier, which lowers delivery and service costs for its customers. These companies are trying to keep switching costs high. So, you know, you want to feel like the more you use this service, the more you save. If delivery costs $3 typically for every order, the more orders you deliver, the more you squeeze out of that $13 a month subscription. So they're trying to keep switching costs high and trying to increase the willingness of customers to buy without thinking.
All right. So those are the five strategies. We said at the beginning that this is sort of a big experiment. So what are the takeaways here? Are there certain hypotheses that are clear winners and losers?
Well, I think one of the clear winners is definitely more pricing options for customers so they can self-select into whatever tier they're most comfortable paying, and that maybe premium pricing wasn't the right move. But the truth is this pandemic is going to go on for several more months or potentially another year, and pricing changes all the time. And in the course of my reporting, the story had to change multiple times because the prices kept changing, perks kept being added on to bundles. And so it seems like companies are still trying to figure this whole thing out, as we all are.
Fair enough. All right. Our personal tech columnist, Nicole Nguyen, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Amanda.
And that was your tech news briefing. You can find more tech stories on our website, WSJ.com. And if you like our show, please do rate and review us in your app store. It really does help. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.